This is the August 2020 Negligence Update CLE. It's based on New York State appellate decisions released in August of 2020 dealing with issues related to negligence. The selected decisions were summarized. The summaries were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website, and they've been compiled into the August 2020 Negligence Update pamphlet. It's that pamphlet which serves as the written materials for this course, and the page numbers are to that pamphlet. First case, page 3, Pasek versus Catholic Health Systems. It's a medical malpractice case, and it deals with a plaintiff's abandonment of causes of action that are not addressed in response to a defendant's motion for summary judgment. The court wrote, "A medical malpractice defendant meets his or her initial burden on a motion for summary judgment by presenting factual proof generally consisting of affidavits, deposition testimony, and medical records to rebut the claim of malpractice by establishing that he or she complied with the accepted standard of care or did not cause any injury to the patient. We agree with defendant that he satisfied his initial burden on the motion with respect to both compliance with the accepted standard of care and proximate cause by presenting factual evidence, including his own detailed affidavit, that addressed each of the specific factual claims of negligence raised in plaintiff's bill of particulars. The burden thus shifted to plaintiff to raise an issue of fact by submitting an expert's affidavit establishing both a departure from the accepted standard of care and that the departure was approximate cause of the injury. Inasmuch as plaintiff's expert failed to address the claims against defendant regarding the diagnosis, consulting, testing, examination, and pre- and post-operative treatment, and did not identify any deviation with respect to defendant's efforts to ventilate, monitor, or resuscitate the plaintiff, Pasek, those claims are deemed abandoned." So the takeaway here is, in the context of a summary judgment motion in a medical malpractice action, the plaintiff's expert must address every claim in the bill of particulars which is sufficiently addressed by the defendant's expert. The plaintiff's expert's failure to address any such issue is an abandonment of that issue. Next is matter of Ad Belgany versus the City of New York on page 4. It deals with the need to file a notice of claim and an application for leave to file a late notice of claim where there's a negligence action against a municipality. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the application for leave to file a late notice of claim should not have been granted. Plaintiff alleged the city and the fire department, those are the appellants, were negligent in the response to a 911 call made after petitioner's daughter was discovered drowning in a swimming pool. The petitioner did not demonstrate the appellants were timely made aware of a potential negligence action. The court wrote, "The petitioner's daughter's pulse and breathing were restored in the ambulance, and nothing in the records maintained by the appellants revealed the extensive injuries that the petitioner's daughter allegedly suffered. Despite the appellant's knowledge of the facts surrounding the response to the 911 call, there was little to suggest injury attributable to any negligence on their part." So the takeaway, whether leave to file a late notice of claim should be granted depends in large part upon whether the municipality had timely knowledge of a potential lawsuit. It's not enough that a municipality is aware of the injuries at the time of the incident. The municipality must also have timely knowledge of its potential negligence, which was missing in this case. Next is the Hanus versus Long Island Railroad case on page 6. It's a slip and fall case, and it brings up a theory of liability that I've not seen before. The Second Department determined the action against the town should not have been dismissed. Notwithstanding the town code, the state highway law may require maintenance of the sidewalk by the town. In addition, the town did not demonstrate that it didn't have written notice of the alleged sidewalk defect. The court wrote, the plaintiffs raised a tribal issue of fact as to the applicability of State Highway Law Section 140, Subdivision 18, which imposes a duty on the town to maintain certain sidewalks adjacent to state highways and county roads. The town failed to submit evidence that its employees or agents had specifically searched the records maintained by the town clerk to determine whether it had prior written notice of the alleged sidewalk defect as per the requirements of the town code. In addition, the town failed to establish that the alleged sidewalk defect was too trivial to be actionable. But the takeaway here is the possible applicability of a state law requiring the town to maintain a sidewalk that's adjacent to state highways and county roads. This is the first case I've seen which mentioned that state highway law may impose a duty on a town to maintain sidewalks over and above any duty imposed by the town code. Next is the Wilson case on page 7. It's a proximate cause case. It's second department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant New York City Housing Authority's, that's NYCHA's, summary judgment motion in this playground injury case should have been granted. Plaintiff alleged a water sprinkler in which children could play was too close to the monkey bars, and infant plaintiff was injured falling from the wet monkey bars. However, the plaintiff presented evidence that children who were wet from playing in the sprinkler had climbed the monkey bars before infant plaintiff slipped and fell. The second department held that finding the housing authority negligent would have to be based upon speculation. The court wrote, the infant plaintiff testified at the 50H hearing and in his deposition that the wind was pushing water from the sprinkler to the monkey bars. However, the infant plaintiff also testified at his deposition that immediately before he went on the ladder to the monkey bars, two children who were wet from playing in the sprinkler climbed the ladder. Where the facts proven show that there are several possible causes of an injury, for one or more of which the defendant was not responsible, and it is just as reasonable and probable that the injury was the result of one cause as the other, plaintiff cannot have recovery since he or she has failed to prove that the negligence of the defendant caused the injury. Given the wet children who preceded the infant plaintiff on the ladder, it would require impermissible speculation to conclude that the water on which the infant plaintiff slipped was caused by the proximity of the sprinkler to the monkey bars. So the takeaway here, it's clear that the water came from the sprinkler, whether directly or carried by the kids who are wet from the sprinkler, but the court determined the city could only be liable if the water from the sprinkler hit the monkey bars directly, and a jury could not come to an evidence-based conclusion on that question. The case might be a weak example of the principle, but it's important to know the principle. A jury faced with two equally possible causes for an injury will not be allowed to speculate. Next is Matter of Mary Beth on page 8. It's a student-on-student third-party assault case. It deals with an application to file a late notice of claim against the school district. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held claimant's petition for leave to file a late notice of claim on the school district in this student-on-student third-party assault case should not have been granted. The court wrote, in determining whether to grant such leave, the court must consider whether the claimant has shown a reasonable excuse for the delay, whether the municipality had actual knowledge of the facts surrounding the claim within 90 days of its accrual, and whether the delay would cause substantial prejudice to the municipality. Claimant described the assault on her child as unprovoked, and the accident report prepared contemporaneously by the school nurse, which claimant submitted with her reply affidavit, describes a single punch resulting only in a headache and swollen face. Inasmuch as an injury caused by the impulsive, unanticipated act of a fellow student ordinarily will not give rise to a finding of negligence absent proof of prior conduct that would have put a reasonable person on notice to protect against the injury-causing act, we agree with respondent that the known facts failed to give reasonable notice from which it could be inferred that a potentially actionable wrong had been committed by the school. So the takeaway here, in deciding whether to grant leave to file a late notice of claim, the courts look for evidence the defendant had timely notice of a potential lawsuit, not merely timely knowledge of the incident. A single unprovoked attack by one student on another student is generally not foreseeable from the school's perspective. Based on what the school personnel knew about the incident when it happened, they would not have had reason to believe the school could be held liable in negligence. Next is the Stephanie L. case on pages 9 and 10. It's another third-party assault case, this time the assault by a foster child on the couple's biological child. The theories that the plaintiff used were a fraud theory and a negligence theory. The Fourth Department determined the fraud cause of action was not time-barred and further determined that defendants owed a duty which supported the negligence cause of action. The plaintiffs, who had a biological child, took in a foster child through Good Shepherd, a placement service. The plaintiffs were not aware that the foster child had a history of animal abuse and sexually inappropriate behavior. One day after plaintiff's adoption of the foster child, the child sexually assaulted the biological child, and the plaintiff sued in both fraud and negligence, and Supreme Court denied Good Shepherd's motion to dismiss. The court wrote, "A defendant's mere knowledge of something is not an element of a fraud cause of action. Instead, a fraud cause of action requires a showing of the false representation of a material fact with the intent to deceive. Even assuming that Good Shepherd knew of the foster child's history of animal abuse and engaging in sexually inappropriate behavior as early as May 2008, we conclude that its knowledge thereof did not demonstrate that the alleged fraud occurred at that time. Good Shepherd submitted no evidence that in May 2008, it falsely represented the foster child's relevant history with the intent to deceive the plaintiffs. Thus, it did not establish, as a matter of law, that the fraud cause of action accrued in 2008. So this is an unusual situation where the defendant placement service is trying to say that if there was fraud, it occurred back when the child was first placed with the plaintiffs in 2008, and therefore the statute of limitations had run on the fraud cause of action. But the Supreme Court found that just the placement agency's knowledge of the violent aspect of the child's behavior was not enough to meet the criteria for fraud, and therefore the statute did not start running in 2008, and the fraud action was timely. Now, the other aspect of this case, the plaintiffs brought a negligence action against the placement service, and the placement service argued that it did not have control over the foster child, which had been living with the plaintiffs for 4 years, and therefore did not owe a duty to the biological child. The court wrote, "Although defendants contend that they did not owe the biological child a duty because they lacked control over the foster child during the 4 years that he lived with plaintiffs, control over a third-person tortfeasor is just one way to establish a duty. A duty may also exist where there's a relationship between the defendant and the plaintiff that requires the defendant to protect the plaintiff from the conduct of others. And the key is that the defendant's relationship with either the tortfeasor or the plaintiff places the defendant in the best position to protect against the risk of harm." So there are two takeaways from this case. With respect to the fraud, the trigger an action for fraud, there must be a false representation made with the intent to deceive. Therefore, the fact that the placement service was aware of the foster child's behavior problems in 2008 was not sufficient to start the statute of limitations running on the fraud cause of action. And with respect to the negligence cause of action and the existence of a duty, the duty imposed on the placement service was announced by the Court of Appeals in a fairly recent case, Davis versus South Nassau Communities Hospital, that's 26 New York 3rd, page 56, 2015 case. The duty is based on the idea that the placement service may have been in the best position to protect the biological child against the risk of harm. Next is Matter of New York City Asbestos Litigation on pages 10 and 11. Obviously, it's an asbestos case, toxic torts, and the issue was whether the evidence of causation of the disease was sufficient. The First Department, although finding some of the damage amounts excessive, held over a dissent, the plaintiff's multi-million dollar verdict in this asbestos exposure case was supported by the evidence. The case hinged on expert evidence that the extent of the exposure was sufficient to cause the resulting illness. The dissent argued the expert evidence did not meet the criteria imposed by the Court of Appeals. The court wrote, in this asbestos case, Marlena, plaintiff, who died after the trial of this cause of action, testified that working with her husband and co-plaintiff, she had been regularly exposed to visible dust from scraping and grinding engine gaskets over a period of years, from cleaning the family garage after each gasket change, and from taking her and her husband's dusty clothes into the laundry room to clean. Defendant, Federal Mogul's corporate representatives, as well as the various experts called by defendants at trial, testified that the gaskets contained anywhere from 50% to 85% asbestos. And plaintiff's experts testified that dust from these products, if visible, necessarily exceeded current permissible levels and contained sufficient levels of asbestos to cause plaintiff's peritoneal mesothelioma. The experts did not merely testify as to only an increased risk. Dr. Schwartz testified that the visible dust from the gaskets at issue, which were conceded by defendant's expert to contain between 50 and 85% asbestos, 80% being the standard, necessarily contained several thousand times the safe amount of asbestos and thus was causative of plaintiff's disease. And this is from the dissent. It should be borne in mind that the decedent's relevant alleged exposure to asbestos from the products was restricted to helping her husband remove gaskets from his cars once or twice in a month over a period of 12 years. It should also be remembered that only about half of the gaskets involved were defendant's products, that not all of the defendant's gaskets contained asbestos, and that any asbestos that the gaskets did contain was of the less hazardous variety. So the takeaway here in this asbestos case is that expert testimony that visible asbestos dust contains several thousand times the safe level of asbestos was a proper basis for the expert's conclusion plaintiff's exposure to the dust over 12 years caused her illness. Next is Alexandra R. on pages 11 and 12. Its importance is related to the powers of an appellate court to set aside a verdict. This was a traffic accident case. Fourth Department, refusing to follow any decisions to the contrary, held, despite the defendant's failure to make a motion to set aside the verdict, the appellate court may review the record and render a judgment warranted by the facts. The Fourth Department, over a two-justice dissent, reversed the plaintiff's verdict in this traffic accident case. Defendant, an employee of the New York State Thruway Authority, was the driver of a dump truck parked on the shoulder of the throughway while other employees picked up debris in the median. The truck was parked 18 inches to the left of the fog line. Plaintiff's van drifted out of its lane and struck the back of the dump truck. The plaintiffs argued defendant was required by the relevant regulations to pull off as far from traffic as feasible. The Fourth Department held that although failure to pull off the highway further than 18 inches may demonstrate a lack of due care, it did not demonstrate recklessness as required by Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1103. The court wrote, at the time of the collision, defendant had parked the truck entirely outside of the travel lane, approximately 18 inches to the left of the yellow fog line, on or near the rumble strips located on the shoulder. Defendant had also activated multiple hazard lights on the truck, which consisted of regular flashers, two amber lights on the tailgate, beacon lights, and four flashing caution lights on the aero board. Moreover, the undisputed evidence established that there were no weather, road, or lighting conditions creating visibility or control issues for the motorists on the morning of the incident. Even if, as the court found, defendant knew or should have known that vehicles occasionally leave the roadway at a high rate of speed due to motorists being tired, distracted, or inattentive, we conclude that here it cannot be said that defendant's actions were of an unreasonable character in disregard of a known or obvious risk that was so great as to make it highly probable that harm would follow, and done with conscious indifference to the outcome. So the takeaway here is the Fourth Department, agreeing with the Second Department, held the appellate court has the power to consider whether a judgment is supported by the weight of the evidence, even where no motion to set aside the verdict has been made. The failure to move to set aside the verdict is not an impediment to appellate review. Next is the Green case on pages 12 and 13. It's a bicycle vehicle accident case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the action by the plaintiff bicyclist against the defendant driver should have been dismissed. Plaintiff ran into the back of defendant's car as defendant was stopped or was stopping to park the car. The court wrote, Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1231 provides that every bicyclist is subject to all of the duties applicable to the driver of a vehicle. A bicyclist approaching another vehicle from the rear is required to maintain a reasonably safe distance and a rate of speed under the prevailing conditions to avoid colliding with the other vehicle. That's Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 1129, Subdivision A. A rear-end collision with a stopped or stopping vehicle establishes a prima facie case of negligence on the part of the operator of the rear vehicle, requiring that operator to come forward with evidence of a non-negligent explanation for the collision to rebut the inference of negligence. The evidence established that the plaintiff was negligent in failing to see what was there to be seen because he was not paying attention to the road conditions ahead while he was riding his bicycle at a fast rate of speed, and that he failed to maintain a reasonably safe distance from the defendant's vehicle, which, according to the plaintiff, was stopped at the time of the impact. The plaintiff's contention in opposition that the defendant made a sudden stop before attempting to park his car was insufficient to raise a triable issue of fact as to whether the defendant was negligent in the operation of his vehicle. So the takeaway here is a bicyclist, like the driver of a vehicle, is required to see what there is to be seen, to maintain a safe speed, and to maintain a safe distance from any vehicles ahead of the bicyclist. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this August 2020 negligence CLE update. The verification code is bicycle. Again, the verification code for this August 2020 negligence update CLE is bicycle. And the final case here is a traffic accident case in which the defendant alleged that the accident caused cognitive deficits, and it raises an evidentiary issue about whether a notice has to be provided if the plaintiff's treating physician testifies. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there was no need for the defendants to give prior notification to the plaintiff of the defendant's intent to call one of plaintiff's treating doctors to testify about the cause of plaintiff's cognitive deficits. The doctor would have testified the deficits were caused by a prior stroke. The testimony was precluded by Supreme Court because no expert witness notice had been provided to the plaintiff pursuant to CPLR 3101 subdivision D. The plaintiff was awarded $2 million, but the Second Department held the verdict should have been set aside. The court wrote, "A treating physician is permitted to testify at trial regarding causation, notwithstanding the failure to provide notice pursuant to CPLR 3101 subdivision D1. Indeed, a plaintiff's treating physician could testify to the cause of the injuries even if he or she had expressed no opinion regarding causation in his or her previously exchanged medical report." Here, the Supreme Court should not have precluded the plaintiff's treating physician from testifying regarding causation based on the defendant's failure to provide notice pursuant to CPLR 3101, as that provision does not apply to treating physicians. Accordingly, Supreme Court should have granted that branch of defendant's motion, which was pursuant to CPLR 4404 subdivision A, to set aside the verdict on the issue of damages in the interest of justice and for a new trial on that issue. So the takeaway here, again, the expert witness notice required by CPLR 3101 subdivision D1 does not apply to plaintiff's treating physician, who may be called by the defense to give an opinion about the cause of plaintiff's injuries, even if the doctor's medical records don't address the issue. And that completes this August 2020 negligence update CLE.